Well, thank you so much for joining us here today. Again, this is Jeff Schrapper with Common Good, and we are here talking today specifically with Alexandria Lofsy.
Perfect.
We just found out we had actually been at an event together probably January of last year. So this will be fun to actually get to know you a little bit more. And then I know you've worked with Steven on my team a little bit. And from my knowledge of you, which is why I'm excited to dig in, you've had a real deep passion for affordability of housing as well as kind of homelessness all wrapped into one. Did I say that right?
That's right. Yeah.
And so today you are what, the founder and I'm assuming managing director of Hometown Ventures, which we'll learn a little bit about.
Home Team Ventures, like root for the home team.
Home Team. Okay, yeah. So you'll have to then explain why it's called Home Team. And then you also co-founded New Story, who I'm a little more familiar with. Is that accurate?
That's right.
Well, I got to start with, so I actually got into impact investing. I made my first investment, and when I say I, my wife and I made our first investment probably in 2014, and it had to do with affordable housing. So I'm anxious to hear your thoughts, rendition of what the problem are, what are the opportunities, which I'm sure we'll get into. But before we do that, give us a little background on yourself, specifically where'd you grow up, where'd you go to school, and then maybe just a quick overview of your career, and I may jump in and ask some questions as well.
Amazing. So like you said, I run Home Team Ventures, and Home Team invests in early stage construction technology businesses. So I always get, especially as, you know, a Black and Middle Eastern woman, like, why are you in construction? Why are you in particular? Like, I get a lot of, you know, raised eyebrows. It makes me memorable. But people are very curious about why I'm investing in construction technology specifically. And it really does start at the root. So I grew up in Section 8 housing. So, and actually, if I go even further back, my mother grew up in foster care. I myself grew up in Section 8 housing. We moved a lot. I went to 7 or 8 different schools. I would move mid-year. And so I, through the experience of my mother, her siblings, myself, just really understood from the very beginning how important it is to have housing and what the impacts could be when you don't have it. That lived experience, also growing up fairly low income, made me highly convicted that I wanted to work on equalizing the playing field. And so I went on to study actually international development and social impact and economics in undergrad. Right after undergrad, I did Teach for America. So I wanted to be an impact, but it wasn't necessarily housing until I did Teach for America. And about a third of my students were homeless or housing unstable for all or part of the year. This was in Washington, D.C. And when they were experiencing these bouts of housing instability, it was really difficult for them to pay attention, of course, right, to the figurative language lesson that I was giving them if they didn't know where they were going to sleep that night, if they hadn't, you know, had a shower in a few days. Also, beyond the students, it was really difficult for their parents to attain jobs or retain jobs when they didn't have a permanent address. And so, you know, I really have always been attracted to working on problems or solving problems that feel like a really big lever. And housing felt like something increasingly in that experience where if you solve the housing piece, you actually, you know, create the necessary conditions for all other types of flourishing and thriving. And so I got very passionate about housing, you know, through my teaching experience. I will skip a few steps and say I was happened to then be in Atlanta working in supply chain logistics. My mother had passed away, actually. So, and I then became the guardian of my 13-year-old sister. So I needed to take the highest paying job I could find. That's what brought me to Atlanta. But I still like had, you know, on my nights and weekends, I wanted to work on social impact and housing in particular. I went to for social entrepreneurs and met my two incredible co-founders. Their name are Matthew and Brett. Together, starting in 2014, we started New Story, which is a nonprofit that it still exists today. We've built thousands of homes in places like Haiti and places like El Salvador and Mexico and Bolivia. And through that work, I learned a lot about, of course, construction and building communities and what the barriers are. And many of those learnings led to starting Home Team Ventures. I can talk about those.
Thank you, by the way, for way of your background. And it does give great context. One, let's go back to basics, because ironically, the first investment that my wife and I made was in Section 8 housing. And so can you explain what Section 8 housing is and isn't, just so everybody is clear of what that is? And then I can even briefly just mention, if it makes sense, what the investment opportunities are or the need around that. So go ahead.
What is the type of project you invested in? I'm curious.
it wasn't me. It was a fund manager here in Orlando at the time was buying Section 8 properties. So, you know, it can either be the Section 8 can be with the building and the rooms, or it can be voucher based that goes with it. This would be 50% rundown properties. And they were actually, if I'm not mistaken, I think they were taking them out of the Section 8 program and fixing them up. And I will tell you, because actually it's really important, fixing them up and still keeping them affordable, but not definitionally by capital A affordable. But it was two residents when I was watching this little video on it. And one of them was explaining what it was to like live in this community after this group bought it, fixed it up, and put in new management. And one of them said, they'd given me my dignity back. And it was like, wow. And I'm sure appreciate the quote. And the second one said, resident said, and I'm so excited to have people come to my house now. And that's really where the light bulbs went on for me. But in the Section 8 housing world today, the opportunities that we see is actually, rather than them getting out of the Section 8 housing program, it's extending the life of them once you get past all the tax credits. So
yeah, I love that you mentioned dignity, because I haven't thought about my own lived experience in Section 8 housing in a very long time. But I do now that I'm thinking about it, remember once we, you know, it was an extremely long process for my mom to, and then later my aunt to go through and get accepted into the program. It was the difference maker for the schools that I was then in. Could finally get, afford a place in really good school districts, who knows what my trajectory would have been. Had that not been the case. And then it is true, actually, that we're able to be in slightly nicer houses, and I felt comfortable having friends over for sleepovers and, you know, birthday parties and things. But yeah, Section 8 housing is officially called the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Section 8 is like more colloquial. It's a federal program that helps low-income families afford rent in the private market. So instead of placing people in government-owned housing, it gives them a voucher. And families typically pay about 30% of their income toward rent, and the voucher covers the rest up to local limits. The idea, you know, it's really powerful because it gives people choice. Like I mentioned, in certain school districts they want to be in, or maybe they're now able to be close to certain family members, and like the lower income you are, the more support networks are really important to thriving. And it works in the existing housing market. You asked about limitations. They are real. I think it's wonderful. And I'm always excited when I read about the expansion, you know, of the program. Funding is capped, and it always will be. You know, wait lists can be years long. Not all landlords accept vouchers. And in many cities, the rent limits, like those caps, don't fully keep up with market prices, which makes it actually hard to use the voucher in the way that it was originally intended. So it's one of the biggest kind of tools we have in housing affordability, but it of course doesn't come close to meeting the full demand. And then, you know, we have a housing supply crisis in the United States, and that's making it difficult for everyone to access housing, even, you know, higher income and middle income people, and certainly lower income people trying to use these vouchers.
Yeah, you bring up something really interesting. So we have been involved at Common Good with traditional, and I say capital A affordable, just definitionally, that means you are typically using tax credit dollars. You know, a lot of people in the investing world think of affordable housing just as cheaper priced. That's not technically true. But where I was going to go with this is, it's amazing the discussions that I've gotten into with people over the years who say a capital A affordable multifamily is more impactful than a workforce housing, which workforce does not have any government involvement. And I always just kind of step back and say, well, if you are cost burdened at whatever level you're at, I'm not here to say one is worse or better than the others, but there's just an affordability crisis across the spectrum, regardless of your income. Now, obviously at a certain level, when you get enough, it's a bit, you know, move someplace else. But it's not just low income. It's your policemen, firemen, nurses. I mean, it's down the middle of the fairway that on one income, really hard to live.
Absolutely. And especially in your metropolitan areas, right? Like I live in San Francisco, and just last week we had a teachers union strike that lasted multiple days. It's still not fully resolved. And it's because the cost of living, like why should our teachers, our firefighters, our police officers, our wait staff, you know, why should these people have to live and commute 1-2 hours away from where they work? Often they do that. That's not sustainable. So eventually they end up, you know, your best, let's say teachers, don't end up living in the cities. that leads to a further degradation of already troubled schools. And then also, I was a teacher, I did teach for America, and it was really powerful to have teachers who lived in the same communities as the students. You got to know the coaches, you got to know the parents more intimately, you ran into the students at the supermarket, and that allowed for the deeper level connection I think required, particularly in for students that are in more troubled school districts. So it's really, it all connects together. Housing is such a, no pun intended, like foundational core part of communities thriving. And so we talked a little bit about Section 8 housing, the housing supply crisis, why it's making it harder for, people across the board. The housing supply crisis, and that ties to what I do with Home Team Ventures and my evolving view on how to work on this problem and why being a social entrepreneur was such a big part of my identity. And so it's like, it's curious to people around me that I'm now an investor, but I decided long ago that stability, housing affordability was my personal North Star. And so I've gone really, really deep into how to actually solve that problem. Section 8 is amazing. I benefited from it, but really it is, it's a band-aid, right? Like it's something that we use to try to solve one of the systemic issues, which is that there just isn't enough affordable housing supply. And at Home Team Ventures, we really try to solve the root causes of that, namely the costs of construction. And so, a lot of the national conversation around the reasons why we don't build enough really centers on zoning and permitting. That's often the first, few things that come up. And it should, like those are like some of, if not the biggest barriers. But when you get over those hurdles, and I talk to general contractors, all the time, and I did a big listening tour of general contractors before starting this fund. When you ask general contractors what the biggest barriers are, they're talking to you about not the zoning and permitting, they're telling you about the labor, the rising labor costs, and how they don't know if the cost of labor today is going to be the same, a year from now when the project actually starts. They're talking to you about the material costs and the same thing, right? They underwrite a project in 2026. Project's not starting until 2027, usually. And the project can go belly up because the costs are so different. And so once you get over the permitting, let's say we get over the zoning issues, the math just actually does not work for affordable housing in America. And that's the reason why almost all affordable housing projects require government subsidies and investments from kind, investors like yourself and others who are really oriented toward impact. So I think we have to make that math pencil. And when you think about efficiency, doing things at higher speed, at lower cost, technology has been really good at that in many other industries, right? Plummeting costs, increasing efficiency and speed. So, why shouldn't that be the case in construction? I firmly believe that it is. So we look for technology that can significantly decrease construction costs to make the math work so that all developers and certainly affordable housing developers can do more for every dollar because we've got so much to build.
So give me your assessment of the root cause being real estate pricing or construction and associated cost. Let's just take a building and then we'll make it up and say it's $500,000. And X of it is just the land itself, the real estate, and X is the building and the construction. So from your analysis, do we have a building and construction problem or do we have a land cost problem?
We certainly have both. If you look at people, including myself, when they're first looking into the industry, will often get frustrated that there actually is quite a lot of building that is happening, but it is like luxury building. Like if you look in San Francisco, LA, New York, there's a lot of, I mean, I live right in the epicenter of a lot of luxury buildings being developed. And it's kind of like, if we know we have this housing issue and we need more affordable workforce housing, why are so many luxury units being built? But if you look at two projects side by side, to your point, right, the land cost is the same, right? If one's an affordable housing project and one's a luxury project, the land costs are the same, the labor costs are the same, right? You don't get cheaper labor because you're doing affordable housing. Maybe you get a credit. The material costs are the same. Really, if you're building the same two buildings, like for the affordable housing building, some of your fixtures are different, right? But like your cost of your steel beams, the cost of everything that actually has large expense is the exact same. And so for most developers in America, they're gonna choose, they have to exist as a business, right? And so that's the reason why, even if they have a heart for building affordably, they know that they can't stay in business if they do. I have a developer who's a limited partner of mine who he said to me directly, like, hey, I made all of my money already. All I want to do is build affordable housing. The only reason why I can do it sometimes is because I have become an expert in getting these government housing credits. Like I spend a lot of my time in DC. That's the only way that I can do it. And most developers don't have that skill set, don't, they're not in DC all the time lobbying people for these credits. And so it just doesn't happen. And so, TLDR, it is both. It's the land, but then after that, I think if we are able to, I have a company in my portfolio that is it's a new type of steel framing. The company is called Hyperframe, and they can do that with their system. You can do steel framing, a critical part of, most construction projects above three, four stories. You can do that 8 to 15 times faster. You are saving 30% of your costs on steel waste because with Hyperframe, there's no waste. So that's great for sustainability also. But if you're saving 30% on material costs in that part of the construction value chain, and you're able to do the work about 10 times faster, right? Every day on a job site's really expensive. If that's done faster, then the next step in the process happens faster. And if we can innovate there, then the next, part happens faster. Then projects can, have a better shot of being completed on time. And so, the land stuff, there's not much we can innovate there. But like the cost of land is going to be the cost of land. But there's so much efficiency gain that we can get on do your ground up build.
I love the fact that you're attacking on the materials and the construction side. I'm on the podcast. We had a gentleman, and in fact, I'm going to butcher the name of the company, so I'll leave it out for now. But they are doing 3D printing, and they signed a contract with Walmart. And there's been a lot of work done in that. It's just now starting, and they're now proving it out that it actually can be cheaper. But it's taken a number of years. Now, frankly, the issue they have going forward to scale. It's really about skilled labor who know how to do that stuff. There's this 1 foot forward, then you got to slow down just because of innovation. One question I have for you is that we had not discussed at all, but I'm curious. So I've been in this impact investing space since 2015, let's say 2014, 2015. And in my prior life, I worked with what you would argue is some of the biggest and best names out there, the KKRs, the CBRE, whatever. And I won't go through those names. But what I have been shocked, and so I'd love your thoughts on this, is that the innovation and creativity I have seen in this, I'm going to call it impact space, not only matches, but at times rivals what the big companies are doing. I have a thesis of why that is. Have you seen, I mean, it sounds like what you do, all your stuff is innovative. So any thought on how innovation and making a difference, impact investing coincide? Have you seen that? Or is it because a lot of people would say, impact investing or social entrepreneurship, it's all heart, and it's light on the financials. So I'd just be curious from your perspective, what's been your experience?
One of the first things that comes to mind for me, and this is part of our thesis and what I share when I'm fundraising, is counterintuitively, I invest in construction technology businesses. And most of them sell into like general contractors and developers. And so you have your like Lennar, DPR, right? Like your public companies that are developing lots of buildings and infrastructure. And then you have, most of your development, especially in housing, comes from like local, regional, small to medium size businesses. It is the smaller, affordable housing developers that are often the ones that are more interested in incorporating technology into their businesses. They are the ones that are the most innovative, far more innovative, I have found, than your larger companies that have bigger margins. And the way that the way I think about that is when you are resource constrained, you become very resourceful. I see that in the building industry. I think the most creative people I know, having grown up with very, very low-income people, and then also people with a lot of means, the people who are the most creative, resourceful, innovative, were the ones who had to be because of their circumstances, right? They had no choice. And so I then also see that in investing. I find super creative ideas coming out of funds that are like $10 million, $20 million in size, right? Like if you don't have the management fees to, do what all the things that your traditional firms do, you find really interesting ways to support your founders with, less capital or to engage your LPs. Impact investing is so hard because you're constantly, I don't know if this is fully answering your question, but I think this is a valuable maybe aside is you're kind of serving two masters, which you can't really do, right, fully. And so you're constantly like trying to play a balancing act between your returns and your impact. Like, it is hard enough. Like, I've been a purely social entrepreneur running a nonprofit. It's actually really difficult to create true, meaningful, deep, sustained impact. It's very hard. And it is very hard. Like, most, venture funds, most investing firms, like, don't end up returning real capital to their limited partners. And so to say, it's pretty audacious, a bit of masochism to say, like, I'm going to do both and try to do both well. And you also, that if you're going to try to do both these two things that are really hard at the same time, you're going to have to work harder. You're going to have to be more creative. You're going to have to be more open to innovation. So perhaps that's partly, where it comes from, is we just know our task is so much harder because we're trying to do two hard things at the same time.
You basically articulated what I have seen in my thesis play out. And that is when you define success greater than just financial. So if you put your score, your scorecard out there, which most people have a scorecard of some sort, but still the financial is so much overweight. But if you put the scorecard up there and you have financial and you have these other non-financial metrics and you're trying to hit them all, I actually think it out of necessity. It forces you to think more creatively because of the tension that you just described. So I actually think that problem creates innovation. And that's why I think I've seen more creativity because you can't just answer it the same way that we've always answered it. So it's one of the things that I've really thought about is, and I still say impact investing. We almost could rebrand some of this as innovation because the two to me go hand in hand.
And there are also fewer playbook, right? Like I'm investing venture capital, and so I'm part of a group called Kauffman Fellows, and it's so wonderful because there's such a rich history of how that business has been done well. There's a lot of models to learn from when you're purely in venture capital. There aren't as many models of really successful impact or mission-oriented investors that have done really well on both measures. You have to be creative and innovative when you're trying to kind of create or shape a newer lane.
Let me take us a little bit higher level. I'm gonna step back here and say, okay, so I'm not gonna ask how old you are, but you've been in your career for a while. You've done several things. We clearly see what you're working on right now. But if you were to map your life out to the best of your ability in your head, where are you at right now in the context of your life journey? I know it's a very philosophical question, but I'm just curious if you have any sense of where you're at in this broader context of who you think you're becoming.
For a long time, I was a social entrepreneur. That was an identity I was really proud of. I was on the ground, building homes in the dirt, building teams, building an organization from scratch. And at my core, I'm still very much that person. I'm a builder. I really love taking something from zero to one. That's where I thrive, creating something where there was nothing before. And then over the last few years, I've shifted into investing. Very candidly, I'm still getting my bearings in that role. There are many different muscles that are being exercised, but what makes it feel more natural is that I'm not just investing, right? Like I'm building a firm, building Hometeam Ventures from scratch while helping other founders build their company. So I get to scale and use that building muscle side by side with many of the founders that we work with. And that dual role does feel really invigorating. It's rapid fire learning every day. I feel like a noob so often, but I'm really, really energized by it. What gives me a lot of clarity in this transition is that my North Star hasn't changed. I'm someone who, feels really clear on their North Star. I know that housing is one of the biggest levers for impact in people's lives. I've seen it up close. So my conviction around focusing on housing is very strong. What's changed is the vehicle. I now get to approach that problem from a new angle by backing founders who can move the industry at scale. That's a lot of work talk, I'd say. At the same time, I'm really aware that I'm building a life, not just a firm. I don't want ambition in one bucket and my values in another. I want them compounding, together. I really, really, really want to look back and feel proud, not just of what I built, but how I built it. So with, strong and meaningful relationships, with integrity, with depth of conviction. And I'm a lot less interested in being everywhere or having taken on everything. I think that really defined my 20s. I'd rather go deep in the places where I've actually earned the right to have an opinion. I deeply admire folks who like really know their stuff in, one or a few specific places, who have true mastery. That's what I'm working toward and always will. And yeah, I want to build something that truly lasts, that's truly impactful, impacting the area that I care deeply about. So I'll just say where I am now is this. I'm a builder in a new arena. I'm in a period of intense learning and growth, but with a clear conviction about what I'm building toward. And I feel really grateful that I get to build something of my own while helping others build too.
So your role has changed from what you used to do in one sense, and that is that you're now on the investor side, and you also were out there probably like you did before. You're also garnering more investors to invest in the things that you find investable. So with that, I'm anxious to hear, when did you first realize the power of capital? And maybe how do you think about that today?
I felt this really strong call. I'll tell you a little story. I felt this really strong call to service at a really young age. At like, it was 15 or 16, I wanted to go on a volunteer trip to Peru. My mom was like, oh, if you can fundraise for it, if you can get the money, like go ahead, which was really her way of saying no, because we had no money and we didn't know anyone with any money. But I took that as the green light and challenge. So I would walk to school every day and walk past a neighborhood that had really nice, beautiful homes. So I hand wrote a bunch of letters. I put them in the mailboxes of the nicest houses that I could find on that school. One person called me. She funded my trip. And, you know, that in and of itself is a bit of the power of capital, right? To give you exposure and experiences and, you know, was led to the seed of, you know, me getting into social impact. So that money there was really catalytic, person funding me. So I went on the trip. On the trip, again, I'm 15, 16. A lot of the other volunteers were teenagers or people in their early 20s. Most of us were placed in orphanages or clinics. So we were doing important work. It was direct service work. But there was one volunteer, it was the dad of one of the other volunteers. He was a venture capitalist. So like that was my first exposure. I didn't think about venture capital until like over a decade later, but he was a VC. Because of that, his placement, he was working with small female business owners, helping them think about like pricing and margins and profitability. And I thought even at that time, like that was the coolest placement. And I didn't have language for it at the time. But I could just feel the difference between what I was doing, like helping with triage in a clinic, and what he was doing, that what he was doing was just higher leverage. In the orphanage, I could help for a day. In the clinic, I could assist with triage. It was meaningful, but it was limited to what I did in that moment. With the women business owners, though, the impact is like really compounded, right? If he was helping business price their goods correctly to improve their margins, it didn't just change her week. It changed her family's trajectory. It changed whether her kids stayed in school and, you know, whether they needed charity at all. So that was really the first time, again, at 15 or 16, that I understood like the multiplier effect of capital and the idea that capital could be catalytic and compounding and dignifying. That really stayed with me and planted a seed that in many ways I'm still building on today.
The word dignify. You know, it's interesting. My younger brother lives in Africa, in Rwanda specifically, and that the typical narrative of an American getting capital to Africa is not as an investment, it's as charity. And again, nothing wrong with charity. But if you go to Africa and talk to Africans about this, my brother says he can't, I mean, the amount of conversations that comes up, they don't want to be viewed as charity. They actually want to be viewed as investable. That somebody says, I believe in you. I believe that you can succeed for yourself. I believe you can succeed for me as well as an investor. And so, like, even I do a lot of work in prison ministry stuff, and some of the is housing. One of the things that we're doing is housing. And there's always this thing of, well, why not just give them something or, you know, whatever. And you're like, do you understand that these men want to be able to pay for things? They don't want handouts. And it's such a mindset shift for a lot of Americans because we have so much. So anyways, I love your story. So I think the opposite.
Sorry, just remember, I think all of us can remember when you got your first job, right? And you were able to like pay for your gas money, or when you had your car, or, you know, yourself, right? That feeling of being able to do for yourself, like that's universal. And it's something like from the youngest ages, like we crave independence. So why would you want to create a system of, you know, giving or impact that relies on dependence? So yeah, could not agree with you more.
So I think the opposite side of the coin of the power of capital, you can challenge us if you want, is this idea of stewardship. I'd love to hear your impressions of what stewardship means to you. And you can answer from however, whether it's you in your role as a fund manager or whether it's you, whatever. Share with us how you think about stewardship.
You got the big questions. I think about stewardship in a number of ways. I'll maybe touch on two. On a macro level, simply put, it's leadership and care for what outlasts us. On a micro level, I think it's, and by micro, I mean really the most micro you can get yourself, right? It's managing everything you've been given, your time, your talents, your resources in a really intentional way. You know, going macro again, and in housing especially, stewardship feels bigger than finance. The built environment is not just an asset class. I care. I feel like I can do this forever because it's the built environment is where people raise their kids, where they build wealth, where they find stability, or struggle without it. And the decisions we make today about how housing is designed and financed and built, that, you know, that's going to shape communities for decades, right? Like where we live, our neighborhoods, our street, right? That the things that the coffee shop that we walk to that we like those were decisions that were made, you know, usually decades ago. So for me, thinking generationally means, it means asking different questions, not just like, will this return capital, but what's, and this is how I think when I'm investing, what system does this reinforce? Are we making housing more attainable, climate aligned? Are we backing founders who understand the human weight of what they're building? Right, that's me being a good steward of the capital I'm given, not just thinking very much so about return, financial returns, but also the weight of what I'm reinforcing. When last thing I'll say about housing and communities in the context of stewardship is when you invest in housing and construction technology, and I say this to, you know, my team members and founders, like you're influencing the physical fabric of cities, you're influencing schools and neighborhoods and commute times and air quality. So stewardship means recognizing all the externalities in what you're doing, taking the responsibility to know what those externalities are, and then being intentional about it. In my day-to-day work, it means resisting the temptation to chase trends and instead staying, you know, really committed to the solutions that compound positively over time. I'd say if someone looked back 20 years from now, I would want them to say that I didn't just deploy capital into an industry, that, you know, we helped modernize a system that touches everyone's lives and did it with, you know, care and discipline and integrity.
As you are looking at different investment options, and try to give me just a true answer, not a sales answer. Are you encouraged about the entrepreneurs that are out there in this space trying to solve problems, or is it discouraging?
Oh my God, so encouraged. I think that there has to be, in order to get like the best talent to come into any industry, there has to be like receptive environment for them, I guess would be the way to put it. Like there are some like necessary factors that have to exist. And I think part of the reason why we have such a high quality of founders now is because, one, like people can raise now for construction tech. That wasn't necessarily true like 7, 8, 9 years ago, right? If the construction industry didn't really want to adopt technology at all, which was the case, then why would venture capitalists invest in construction tech, right? There's no outlet for those funds. For reasons we don't have time for, the construction industry is now extremely getting aggressive about adopting technology. That means that it's a good place to invest. That means venture dollars are flowing into the space. Venture firms like mine that are fully dedicated to construction exist now. We're still very rare, but there's also later stage funding. And so founders that were maybe interested in construction tech before, but were like, you know what, if I build here, I'm not going to be able to raise any money. So they didn't, they now are. And so that's one enabling factor that's bringing really high quality talent in. You know, and I'll give some examples. Like there's someone who's at AirUp, which is a big structural engineering firm. Like why would they, if they have a really great idea, why are they going to leave their cushy job to, you know, start something if they can't get funding? Now they can. Someone at MIT, a professor who has, you know, patented like really great technology for the built environment, why are they going to leave their tenured post if they don't think they're going to be able to fund their company for the, you know, multiple rounds? Now they believe they can. So they do spin out and start those companies. And so the funding is there. Related, also, you now have enough of a track record of exits. So, you know, Autodesk bought PlanGrid for nearly $1 billion. Procore went public. I think EquipmentShare just went public like a few weeks ago. So now you're seeing these sizable exits and outcomes in the construction industry that attract founders. The other thing I'll say, because I think, of course, about how I invest from the financial aspect, which, you know, I just touched on, but also impact, is I don't think this is new, but we also get amazing founders who are really impact driven because, like me, a lot of people know how big of a lever, you know, construction is for both housing goals and solving our global housing crisis, and also for climate. I didn't start the fund thinking about climate, but it's really hard to ignore if you're in the housing space that the construction and maintenance of buildings is like 40% of emissions. And so, you know, investing in improving how we build is also one of the biggest levers for meeting our global climate goals. And so that brings really high quality and really impact oriented founders into our space too, which are, of course, the people I love to work with most.
If you could give us one or two key trends to be watching in the construction technology space, what would you say?
The first one is robotics. And so my like prediction is that, you know, you drive, all of us drive by construction sites here and there, and you see a lot of people who are moseying about the construction site. We probably won't have time to talk about all this, the social implications of it, but I do predict that increasingly you're going to start to see more and more machines and robots that are doing that building. We do have, I think that your mind, people's minds first jump to like that taking jobs, and there will be some of that, but actually there's a construction labor crisis in the US. Like, we can't fill the job. So actually we do have a big delta in jobs that are not filled that robotics can help fill. And that'll be, I mean, you already see robotics for like specific disciplines in the construction value chain. Like there's drywalling robots and there's robots that do certain types of bolting. You'll see that more and more. I'm really interested in how those robots, if you will work together. Like, how are you going to coordinate all that different machinery on the job site? I think there'll be really interesting technology there to help that coordination. And then let's see, there's so much. I'd say on a similar end, but something that I don't necessarily think is great for venture capital, but that will certainly be part of construction's future, is of course, manufactured and prefabricated housing. So part buildings or parts of buildings that are built off of the construction job site and then brought onto the job site. I think where some companies have, I won't say gone wrong, but struggled, is trying to build like complete units and then bring them to job sites. I think it will be more module based, where bathroom units or kitchen units, things that can then be modularized and put together on the job site. We still have a lot of work to do, because right now, when those prefabricated units come onto the job site, you lose a lot of the efficiency gain because people don't quite know how to put them together. And there's a lot of mistakes in the process of putting them together. But the future is already here in places like Japan and the Nordics with respect to prefabricated housing. We're catching up, but we will.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a bit strong, but a guy who I've met and spent a lot of time with in the last couple of years. And he's a multifamily owner, but he created a modular housing manufacturer plant. He tried to learn off of, I think it's a group out of Canada, and it just didn't work. And so he had to recreate it himself. And he's now using that. And a chunk of that is in lower income type housing. But it's taken ton of his personal capital and a bunch of learnings. But he's a mission guy. And so, I think you're going to start to see that work. So yeah, actually one of the things he does, which is near and dear to my heart, he hires in his factory a bunch of labor is actually men and women who were formerly incarcerated, which is such a massive need, as you just said, from a shortage, plus they get released, it's hard for them to find jobs. So there's a lot of synergies to be had there.
Incredible. Yeah, I love that. And then I'd say I have an uncle who was incarcerated for much of his life because of being in the wrong place at the wrong time when he was 13. And so from him and people I know of him, when people get like one shot and they realize like this is their opportunity, very seldom do they want to mess that up. I see this in our work at News Story, the nonprofit. People are really surprised. We work with really low income families and their repayment rates are super high, but they know this is my only shot to get a home. So like, I am not going to mess this up. And similarly with a lot of, formerly incarcerated folks, if I know like not a lot of people are offering to hire me. So if this is my one shot, I'm going to really, really do my darndest to ensure that I don't mess it up. And so they can often be the most, reliable folks.
Which is counterintuitive. There's actually there's a group here in Orlando who it's not their sole focus, but is a huge percentage is transitioning services and housing for sex offenders. And it's the same thing. And that's a whole nother, we won't go down that path other than to say, not all of them they're not all created the same, but from a landlord perspective, they are unbelievable renters because the same thing. There's so few places they can live. Now, here's the irony that's why you really need people who are landlords who care about these individuals, because at their vulnerable state, they can be taken advantage of, or it can be a very win-win situation. So it's in those spots where it's somebody who's got a good heart needs to be there.
Let me just say, because you mentioned the trends, and I do, you can cut this out if you want to, but I just can't, obviously, in this day and age, not talk about for just a quick moment about AI. I'll just say that you know, I think construction in particular is one of the areas that's a best fit for AI because it is data rich but insight poor. Like project over project over project, so often construction companies aren't like learning enough project over project, or that all that information is in people's heads. People leave, people transition. And so every project generates massive amounts of unstructured data. And AI is really good at organizing that, right? AI, and then taking in other information that would just take too much time and it would be too complex for today's, especially medium and small GCs to factor in, like, where has material prices? What's been the history of that? What are the predictions around material prices? Let's factor that into our pricing so that we can have bidding that is, you know, more appropriate. And so we're not turned upside down on a project, right? So because of that, like high volume, repeatable workflows, you know, fragmented, like human decision making, that's where AI performs best. And that's really what characterizes construction.
Yes, it would not probably be fitting to not have put in something about AI, just given it's like every day, it's like it's exponential. Okay, last question for you is, if you could have one dream come true for yourself, what would it be?
Back to basics, it would be health for a lifetime. So physical health, mental clarity, energy. It's just so obviously the foundation for everything else. I'm a very ambitious person, and in my personal life and my professional life. So when I think about like the impact that I want to have, but also how I want to show up as a partner and as a friend, all that depends on having the vitality to actually like live that life and to take action. So I'd say a steady baseline of strength and well-being, particularly mental sharpness, that allows all the other dreams to be possible. Sharp and strong in my 90s.
Well, and you know, obviously the studies show that health and your place where you live, the zip code, all of that stuff really matters. So you are extremely congruent in your dreams and what you're actually doing. So I just want to thank you so much for your time. You clearly are an expert in what you're doing. If somebody wanted to find out more about your firm, I'm assuming your website, can you just quickly say that for everybody?
Yes, it's hometeam.vc. So home team, like root for the home team, dot VC. And that's where you could find us, Home Team Ventures on LinkedIn, on Twitter. Yeah, come find us. Let's talk housing.
Thanks for your time, and I love what you're doing. One of the areas that I'd love to see the construction get better and cheaper, specific as it translates to seniors housing. That is an area that really, really, really hard to figure it out. I mean, for multiple reasons. You can't really do much on the real estate side. You can't do a whole lot on the health, on the actual service side, unless you bring in robots, maybe. And so, you know, construction is a huge opportunity and need to try to get. I mean, my mom's in assisted living, and by the grace of God, there's capital for her to live, but man, it's expensive.
Very expensive. Actually, I know someone, I met someone recently who's working on robotics for the elderly. We talked about dignity a little bit earlier. She's someone that I co-work with, so I have heard about what she's working on. But what really it hit home for me when she talked about like toward the end of life, like people, it can change the nature of elderly folks' relationships with their like children in particular, if they have to do certain types of care for them. And so if we could have, you know, robotics come in, it can maintain the nature and dignity of those relationships, which I thought was really compelling. So, yeah, exciting future ahead.
Yeah, things are going to be changed and challenged, and technology, it's so easy for people to go, oh, it's either all going to save the world or, oh, it's all evil. Well, the truth is it's how it gets used. And you'll see plenty of examples on both sides. But my goal is with the discussions that we're having like this, that new technologies are used clearly more for the good than for destruction. So.
And that's the reason why, again, never, ever, ever thought I would be a VC, but who is allocating venture dollars, right? They make decisions on what technologies exist and therefore shape the world, and also how those technologies are deployed, right? Usually I'm the only person on the cap table who's talking to founders about their impact, both negative and positive. I think every founder, especially the ones that are building billion-dollar, super high reach, high scale companies, they should have folks that like their mentors and advisors and LPs who are having real conversations with them about their impact. I think the world would look a lot better, safer, equitable if that were the case.
Well, again, thanks for your time. Really appreciate it. And you clearly are an expert in your field, and we will be rooting and cheering for you. So we have to have you back in. You tell me, when are you going to hit it big? 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, whatever. We'll have you back, and you can give an update on how things are going.
Amazing. I would love that. Thank you, Jeff.
This This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.